The Legal Sunday, the Moral Aspect of the Question, Chapter 6. The Objection to Sunday Laws, that they are immoral in spirit and tendency. If the only result of the Sunday law was to accomplish its amiable purpose of rendering the non-Brownist wretch uncomfortable, its operation might not be quite as objectionable as it is. The discomfort of the non-Brownist may not be very serious in many cases. And if we set off against this the enormous enhancement of the Brownist's felicity, which results from the knowledge that one who does not agree with himself is uncomfortable in consequence of his contumacy, it may be plausibly maintained that the aggregate happiness of the community is increased rather than diminished by the Brownist Sunday law. But though the non-Brownist's discomfort be small, and the comfort of the Brownist exceeding great, yet the principle, de minimis non curat lex, cannot be invoked to justify the Sunday law. And though the net result of such a law be increased happiness, this cannot save it. For, as already shown, the mere fact that a law may be, on the whole, a good thing to have, is no reason whatever for the assumption that an American legislature may enact it. And the fact is that the main objection to a Sunday law is not its effect on the comfort or happiness of the people at all, but its effect on their manners. And though legislation of any character be promotive to the utmost of the general happiness, yet if it be at the same time conducive to general demoralization, and pleasure may be purchased at the cost of character by nations as well as individuals, then it is unwise legislation and blots the statute book. Can this be shown of Sunday laws? That they do produce, and must, from their very nature, produce demoralization in the community? It is believed to be easily demonstrable that these laws are an unmitigated evil in many respects, and that the demoralization they work is so great that the Brownists' delight in their existence cannot be legitimately considered as an offset. This demoralization, as will presently appear, affects the Brownist as well as others, and may be considered as resulting. 1. From the spirit which inspires their enactment. 2. From their non-enforceability. 3. From the immorality which their provisions foster and inculcate.
The harm done under the first head is done largely to those for whose gratification Sunday laws are passed. These laws, by their very presence on the statute book, demoralize and de-Americanize our Brownists. No matter how strenuously they deny it, they are at once demoralized into hypocrites. They instinctively recognize in a Sunday law a union of their church and the state. And this un-American thing, kept ever before their eyes, makes them ever more un-American. The spirit of ecclesiasticism is essentially aggressive. It is the old, old story of the camel by whose earnest solicitation the Arab was persuaded to allow the insertion of the brute's head within the tent, and who shortly afterward insinuated his entire body beneath the canopy and thrust the Arab out altogether. The Sunday law is the camel's head intruding on the state's domain. It constitutes pro tanto, a union of the Brownist church with the state, and its existence is the chief cause and encourager of that moral disease which ever and anon breaks out among us, and is now known, from the name of its most conspicuous recent victim, as Parkhurstism. Parkhurstism is to a large extent one of the penalties we pay for the cheapness and enterprise of modern journalism. For this has developed in every quarter, and nowhere more strikingly than in the pulpit, a sickly hankering after newspaper notoriety, which may be justly described as the characteristic weakness of our age. But the particular manifestation of this influence known as Parkhurstism would probably be lacking in the pulpit, and would certainly rage with far less frequency and violence than it does, but for the Sunday laws. Parkhurstism consists in setting up for the master, in his despite, a kingdom of this world. It consists in the assumption that because a man is a preacher, therefore he knows more about civil administration than those whose lives are given to the study and practice of civil administration. It consists in the application to the clergy and Christian church of those political and militant functions which were assigned to the prophets in the later Hebrew economy of the Old Testament. It consists, in one word, of the union of church and state. and it finds no stronger temptation, no greater justification for its most arrogant assumptions, its most absurd vagaries than the presence, in American statute books, of these Brownist Sunday laws, which admit the authority of ecclesiasticism in civil affairs and embody the union of the Brownist church with the state. And on other people than Brownists, the spirit which inspires the enactment of Sunday laws works its demoralizing effect, in that it prepares their necks for the yoke of the established church, which the Brownists are forever endeavoring to fasten upon them. A little of the yoke is in place already in the Brownist Sunday law. Another joint is fastened in the exemption of church property from taxation. Smaller bits are attached here and there in the shape of provisions against blasphemy, qualifications of religious belief for witnesses, office holders, etc. And the hope ever lives that by being made accustomed to the galling of these detached portions, the patient public may one day be persuaded to have them all linked together in a solid yoke, and submit to be driven and guided by the priests of the Brownist Church by law established. And there is no doubt that there is some ground for this hope, and that the Sunday laws do tend to make the masses of the people more inclined to play the silly part of the Arab in the story, just as they constantly stimulate the spirit of the camel in our Brownists. But if the political sense of the non-Brownist portion of our people is dulled, and their watchfulness over their liberties weakened by Sunday laws, it is nonetheless true that their moral character is seriously impaired by these laws. Enough has been said of the blasphemous materialistic notion which Sunday laws promulgate, that the Creator needed rest like a man. From a secular standpoint, the notion they promulgate, that physical idleness is a good thing in itself, and that the state is conferring a boon upon the citizen by allowing him an opportunity to indulge therein, is no less pernicious and objectionable. No more immoral lesson could be preached by any legislation than this. The thoughtful student of our history will note a remarkable difference between the zeitgeist of our time and that of 50 years ago regarding this question of labor and idleness. Horace Mann once voiced what was considered the distinctive American doctrines upon the subject. In Europe, labor had for centuries been considered degrading. To be respectable, one must be idle. A very few years since, a great English novelist considered that he wrote nothing incredible when he described how a country gentleman turned his brother's picture to the wall and wrote on the back, "Gone into trade." Now, many English noblemen have gone into trade. But for our having slipped away from the teachings of Horace Mann and his school, we might hail this and other like phenomena as triumphs of Americanism, the victory of the Republic's ideals over the prejudices and superstitions inherited from the feudal ages. But alas, Horace Mann and his school are no longer the representatives of Americanism. With them, the dignity, the honor, the physical, moral, and mental advantages of labor were the burden of an incessant song. The divine love, it was proclaimed, tempered justice with mercy in that it made industry pleasant and profitable to all right-minded men when making it necessary for the preservation of the race. With them, not only must every man work to be respectable, but other things, capacity, kind of work, etc., being equal, the most respectable man was the man who worked the hardest. Does any such standard of conduct now obtain in the Republic? We have labor organizations in abundance, knowing the natural tendency of the human heart to shirk, and recognizing the influence of public opinion on individual conduct, we can see from man's standpoint a very desirable function for which such organizations might well be formed. Their object would be, say, primarily, a sort of natural insurance with sick benefits, etc. And then they would fix on the most hours of work and the utmost amount of the best work per hour which a high average of the zealous and industrious among them could healthfully endure, and debar from all advantages of their union any who fell below it. Being labor organizations, their main purpose, of course, would be to develop the capacity for labor and increase the quantity as well as the quality of the output of labor to the utmost. Consequently, they would offer prizes and medals and money to those who should show extraordinary ability in the way of working many hours at a stretch, turning out a large quantity of the best work per hour, etc. And as excellence in labor or anything else can only come out of individuality left to the most perfect freedom, the unions would strenuously set themselves against compelling anybody to do or abstain from anything, save at his own sweet will, unless he interfered with a like liberty in others. But our labor organizations are not constructed on the ideals of Horace Mann. Their standard is the mass and not the individual. Hence, necessarily, they tend to mediocrity instead of excellence. But their standard is not even the average of the mass. It is the lowest plane. It is the standard of the most lazy, shiftless, incompetent among them. Not the most or the best, but the least and the worst possible work is their aim. Instead of regarding work as something so essential to the formation and the preservation of character that a wise man will seek it or even make it for himself, though he has no financial need of it, their doctrine is that work is a pestilent evil, to be avoided to the very utmost. They have cast down the image of industry from its American pedestal and set up the European god of leisure in its place. They teach that laziness is a virtue and energy a vice, and that idleness and not labor is the true end of man. Doubtless, this topsy-turvification of the true American idea is one of the many evils which, along with many advantages, have resulted from the large foreign immigration of recent years. Millions of the most active and aggressive of our citizens have come from countries where the ignominy and shame of labor have been an axiom of thought for many generations. They and theirs have from the very dawn of civilization been looked down upon by idlers because they worked, and have acquiesced as if it were in the nature of things that laborers should be scorned by loafers. They have been accustomed to find themselves classed with beasts of burden because these work, and to tacitly acknowledge the justice of the association. No wonder, then, that their first great idea in coming to the United States is, as soon and as much as possible, to shake off this badge of inferiority and degradation. That when you talk to them of freedom, you suggest to their minds freedom from work and nothing more nor less. How is it to be expected that they should understand the American idea that the loafer is the blackguard and the steady, industrious, faithful laborer is the gentleman? Now, experience shows that the European or feudal conception of work as a badge of inferiority is not inconsistent with a civilization based on other things, such as hereditary rank, militarism, state religion, and the like. All these absurdities and fallacies existing together counterbalance each other, and not only is society held together, but some very high types of character are developed, however great the sacrifice of other lives for theirs. But sound philosophy teaches us that some ideas which experience shows may safely prevail under European social conditions will prove fatal to the free government under which we live. And among those ideas sure to poison the lifeblood of the Republic is the idea that labor is ungentlemanly. The European working man who settles here does not appreciate it, but in his intense desire to work as seldom and as little as possible, he is attaching to labor this foreign stigma and destroying the chief distinction between the zeitgeist of America and Europe, which renders our country so preferable for all such as he. By frankly showing that in his own eyes the work he does is a detestable thing, to be avoided to the utmost, and only done under the pressure of absolute necessity, he is creating a popular idea of himself not as a free and independent citizen, a sovereign ruler with other sovereigns over a great country whose governors are his commissioned representatives, but as a miserable serf, driven to his work like a beast, downtrodden and degraded. It is amazing that it never occurs to our foreign labor agitators that their continual persistence in speaking of working men as slaves and vassals tends gradually to undermine the self-respect of the men and make them more or less regard themselves in that depreciatory light and feel and act accordingly. While such language, too often supported by conduct so childish and reckless as to seem to justify the epithets by which it is incited, must also inevitably conduce to the establishment in the community at large of just that contemptuous idea of wage workers which the words express, and which is the European and feudal and not the proper American and Republican idea about such people. Well then, these foreigners, with their European notion that labor is degrading and idleness is honorable, are by nothing they find here at once so encouraged and helped as they are by the presence of Sunday laws on our statute books. For this foreign idea of theirs is part of the very essence of Sunday laws, and in them they find American states preaching already to their citizens the un-American doctrine that idleness is a good thing in itself, to be desired and sought after for its own sake, and that legislation for the promotion of idleness is a boon from the government to the people. Thus, the evil seed of general Sunday laws not only brings forth the fruit after its kind of special Sunday laws under the influence of labor agitation, but these laws, by their very presence on the statute books, afford a constant suggestion and incentive to those who would have the state abridge the citizens' liberty of labor and contract by the enactment of what is, strangely enough, called labor legislation, such as eight-hour laws and the like, all of which, like the Sunday laws, are reflections on labor and its dignity, and are passed in opposition to it and for the promotion of its direct antithesis, idleness.
Two instances may be mentioned of special Sunday laws, which would never have been dreamed of but for the suggestion of the general law. In 1892, there was an attempt to forbid by law the delivery of ice from wagons on Sunday within the city of Washington, as was done long before in Baltimore. The hardship of such a law, of course, fell entirely upon the poor people, who, having no refrigerators, or very small ones, could not store enough ice on Saturday to last them over until Monday. To the wealthy, no particular inconvenience was occasioned. Now, the first suggestion of such a law as this was born of a dishonest impulse, or that desire to get something for nothing, which was the inspiring impulse of Dick Turpin and Jesse James. The men who delivered ice from wagons wanted to draw 7 days' pay for 6 days' work, and hence they moved for a law making it penal for them to deliver ice on Sunday, but laying no penalty on the employer who should pay them, upon the assumption that they broke that law, and give them as wages what they had done nothing to earn. Of course, neither the sufferings of the poor, nor the immorality of the idea, neither the cruelty nor the rascality of the thing, deterred the Brownist clerics from giving it their enthusiastic support in both cities. Again, there is the case of barber shops. Notwithstanding that one who shaves another on Sunday would seem to offend against most general Sunday laws, there is every now and then a clamor, mostly, it is believed, successful, for the passage of a special act for certain localities against Sunday barbering. Now, this clamor originates, if not in dishonesty, at least in laziness. That it should ever be successful is as serious a reflection on the character and manliness of American legislatures as anything in our political history. And nothing could illustrate better than its success the truth of our proposition that it is not possible for the average American legislator to approach the consideration of any Sunday law without falling at once under the influence of intellectual dishonesty and into a non-legislative frame of mind. Here come a number of barbers, Messrs. A, B, and C, and ask the legislature to compel another certain number of barbers to close their places of business during certain hours every week. And why? Simply because A, B, and C do not choose to keep their shop open during those hours. That is to say, X, Y, and Z are to be compelled to be idle against their will in order that their spirit of industry may not reap its just and wholesome reward in competition with the spirit of idleness which governs the conduct of A, B, and C. Every Sunday law is, indeed, legislation for the promotion of idleness. But the present case is so glaring that it points the moral with peculiar force. We can grasp, in all its monstrous infamy and absurdity, the true nature of such laws by substituting grocers, for instance, in the place of barbers, and Monday in the place of Sunday. Then let us ask,
What legislator would dare to put a premium on laziness by voting for a bill to compel X, Y, and Z to close their grocery stores on Monday because A, B, and C did not desire to keep their grocery stores open on that day? What A, B, and C would dare to clamor for such a law? These laws are also demoralizing by reason of their very presence in the statute book, because they are not reasonably enforceable, or, in fact, enforceable at all. And the value and effectiveness of all law is weakened by the company of laws of this kind. And this quality of non-enforceability Sunday laws share with all other laws directed against vice and immorality, as will presently appear. Clerics, with their minds always fixed on an expected coalescence of church and state, frequently clamor for a law which would plainly be unenforceable, in the same sense that many of the laws which attest the survival of a partial union of the two among us are unenforceable. And when they are asked, "What is the use of making a law which will not be endorsed by public opinion to such an extent as to be reasonably enforceable?" they reply in some such language as that recently used by a distinguished Southern bishop, to the effect that there ought to be laws expressing the moral sense of the people.
"Experience teaches," said, in effect, the dignitary alluded to, "that the moral sense of a people never rises above their legislation." Now, if there is anything in this world which all experience and history do teach, it is that there is no connection whatever between the legislation and the morality of a people. One illustration here is as good as a dozen. Never were sumptuary laws more severe and exacting than in the time of Rome's greatest extravagance and dissoluteness. This was under a despotism. Under a free government, not only is the standard of morality always higher than the standard of the law, but it is found in practice that it is inexpedient to attempt to raise the latter to a level with the former, while the failure of any such attempt is a foregone conclusion. Thus, the moral obligation to do a thing exists without any reference whatever to the question of whether one has promised to do it. And the moral obligation to keep one's promise is not in the least affected by the question of whether or not there was a consideration for the promise. Nor does the form in which the promise may have been embodied in the slightest degree affect its moral obligation. The law does, for economic reasons solely, recognize certain obligations independent of promises and connected with the general or special status of the citizen, such as the obligation of every citizen to keep order and the obligation of a parent to support a child. But it pays no respect whatever to the moral element of any obligation apart from its civil or pecuniary aspect. Thus, the citizen ought to be as decent in solitude as in crowds under the moral law. But the civil law does not follow him into his closet. The parent owes his child kindness. The law will force him to feed and clothe it. So the law requires a consideration for a promise before it will take cognizance of the latter. And certain promises it requires shall be evidenced in a certain way in order to be enforceable in its courts.
"Again, I owe a man money. If time enters into the question at all, surely the longer I owe it, the greater my moral obligation to pay. At least it is grossly immoral to plead my own delinquency for years as a final reason for repudiating the debt altogether. But the law takes no such view of the matter. The moral aspect of the situation does not give it any concern. It looks at the civil aspect alone. It adopts, as a maxim of civil expediency, the principle interest rei publicae ut finis sit litium. It is the interest of the state that there should be a limit of time to litigation. And therefore, it says to my creditor that if he has not within a certain number of years compelled me to pay him my debt, then he shall not compel me to pay it at all. Nor is it any answer for him to plead that it was impossible for him to collect his debt within the time thus arbitrarily fixed. And the law further shows its perfect distinctions in this regard by fixing different periods of limitations for debts attested in different ways. A note must be sued on in so many years, a mortgage debt collected within such a period, a judgment realized upon in another, and so on. Thus, debts have a different dignity in the eyes of the law, but in the eyes of morality, they are one and all the same. We see, then, that at the very foundation of the law lies this distinction between a civil and a moral obligation,
and that it is not necessarily advisable to incorporate into law a point of morals, even where the point is almost universally agreed upon, as in the matter of the lifelong obligation to pay a pecuniary debt. And we must also bear in mind that there is a vast domain of morality wherein there is by no means this approach to universality of sentiment, but on the contrary, a variety of opinions at least as numerous and unlike as the varieties of eyes and hair. And into this domain the law will never penetrate, because it has absolutely no means whatever of deciding between these conflicting opinions, and because of its grand saving principle that it will attempt no impossibilities and will go nowhere without a guide. So much then for the objection to Sunday laws as immoral, alike in spirit and tendency, injuriously affecting those who desire them and those for whose constraint they are desired.